to another episode and the start of year two of Style Points. I'm your host, John Crow. Today, we'll be joined by Air Force critical care anesthesiologist Jesse Picard-Gabriel. Before that, I'll turn it over to Nate Moore, who will introduce this month's guest for our RSI, which of course stands for Resident Selected Information.
Thank you, John. Our RSI today is provided by Dr. A.J. Pagan, one of our CA1 anesthesia residents, and I hope you're hungry for knowledge because he's going to be teaching us about GLP-1 receptor agonists and their perioperative management. Welcome to the show, A.J.
What do drugs like semaglutide, dulaglutide, Ozempic, and Wegovy all have in common? If you thought that they're all GLP-1 agonists, that's right. But if you also thought they are a group of drugs that you are not sure how long to instruct your patients to hold them, that's also right. Luckily, this month of December, the American Society of Anesthesiologists released a new multi-society clinical practice guideline statement that we're going to go over today about the recommendations in the perioperative period. First, glucagon-like peptide 1 receptor agonists, the GLP-1s, are a class of medications that were initially introduced for the treatment of type 2 diabetes. They were more recently approved by the FDA back in 2021 for weight loss in patients who are overweight or obese by BMI with at least one comorbid condition. Glucagon-like peptide is an endogenous hormone that is produced and secreted by intestinal cells in the brainstem after we eat. It works by enhancing the body's natural release of insulin, but also has functions such as inhibiting the release of glucagon from the pancreas, slowing the rate of food absorption, and of course, delaying gastric emptying, the buzzword when we're pre-oping a patient. All of these, in conjunction, reduce your food intake and lead to subsequent weight loss. The clinical implications and side effects of these medications have been a topic of debate when discussing the perioperative management. Common side effects include nausea, vomiting, and delayed gastric emptying, all of which put our patients at increased risk for gastric aspiration when considering your anesthetic plan. The ASA, in combination with the American Gastroenterological Association, American Society of Metabolic and Bariatric Surgery, International Society of Perioperative Care for Patients with Obesity, and Society of American Gastrointestinal and Endoscopic Surgeons, have developed a consensus statement that was recently released in Anesthesiology this December of 2024. The recommendations focus on shared decision-making between the patient, the surgeon or proceduralist, and the anesthesiologist. It is important to note that these are just recommendations derived from consensus opinion and not necessarily from rigorous clinical trial evidence, as these agents are relatively new. The consensus statement itself notes that these should be interpreted as guidance and not evidence-based guidelines, as the statement itself may change as more evidence is gathered. With that disclaimer out of the way, let's talk about the two major recommendations in the guidance. So the first was to assess the pre-procedural risk for aspiration. This is as you would do for any patient prior to any anesthetic. Factors that would increase the risk of aspiration, according to the statement, include being on the escalation phase of dosing of the GLP-1. This is if you're increasing the dosing weekly or the daily formulation, using a higher dose of a GLP-1, using a long-acting GLP-1, such as the weekly formulations, such as Ozempic and Wegovy and Trulicity, or the presence of GI symptoms or delayed gastric emptying in the setting of nausea, vomiting, or abdominal discomfort. Lastly, it mentions conditions beyond GLP-1 usage that can induce delayed gastric emptying, such as uncontrolled diabetes, gastroparesis, pancreatitis, IBS, and then types of bariatric surgery. The second recommendation was, if none of these risk factors exist in your patient, the GLP-1 may be continued perioperatively. If your patient has any of these risk factors, they recommend a liquid diet for at least 24 hours pre-procedurally. This is what you would tell your patients prior to like a colonoscopy or bariatric surgery prep. This is to reduce the retained gastric contents inside the stomach. In this scenario, the GLP-1 agent may either be held or continued, and the guidance recommends weighing the medical risks of holding therapy and hyperglycemia against the risk of aspiration when making this decision. If the decision is made to hold the GLP-1, the duration of holding should follow the original ASA statement and guidance. So if your patient is on a daily formulation, to hold the day prior, or if they're on a weekly formulation, to hold the week prior. To summarize, the perioperative assessment phase before we move into the day of procedure, step one of their statement says to assess your patient for signs and symptoms of delayed gastric emptying and conditions associated with it. If none of these exist, you can continue the medication perioperatively. If mild symptoms exist, they recommend a pure liquid diet for 24 hours, similar to colonoscopy or bariatric surgery prep, and it may be okay to continue the medication. If severe GI symptoms or in the shared decision-making model, the decision is made to hold the medication, hold daily formulations the day prior to your procedure, or if a weekly formulation, to hold the week prior. Now moving on to the day of surgery. If the GLP-1 was continued, evaluate your patient for signs and symptoms again of delayed gastric emptying. If no symptoms exist, proceed with the procedure as planned, as if there were no concern for delayed gastric emptying. When considering induction, RSI versus normal induction would be very provider and practice dependent in this scenario. If there are symptoms or a determination of elevated risk of delayed gastric emptying, you could consider a point of care gastric ultrasound. That being said, these can be technically and logistically difficult for these patients to further assess the stomach contents. They also mentioned this is a scenario where you can consider rapid sequence induction. And lastly, to engage the patient into the shared decision-making and to weigh the benefits and risks with proceeding with precautions such as a rapid sequence induction against the risks of procedural cancellation. And lastly, note that these are all the recommendations for anyone taking a GLP-1, regardless of its indication. Now you have the knowledge you need to manage GLP-1 agents effectively and aspire to no aspiration inductions.
Jesse Picard-Gabriel is a lieutenant colonel in the Air Force and a critical care anesthesiologist that works with me here at the University of Cincinnati Medical Center. Dr. Picard has been on active duty for the past 20 years, including deployments to Afghanistan, Djibouti, and Niger, as well as numerous other operations around the world. In his current role here at UC, he's an instructor for the Critical Care Aeromedical Transport Team Course, or CCAT, and one of the intensivists that works in a variety of critical care settings here at the University of Cincinnati. Jesse, thanks for joining us.
Welcome. We should start up. I'm happy to be here. This is the first time I've done this, so forgive me if I'm nervous or if my answers aren't all coherent.
You know, you don't really strike me as a nervous guy.
That's good. That's good. That means I'm hiding it well.
Excellent. I think that's something that we all get really good at in anesthesia, is hiding how nervous we are in a variety of situations.
So obviously you heard a little bit about my intro. I've done a decent amount of traveling. I still get nervous when I take a weekend road trip 150 miles away. What? Before I leave the house, like, I have butterflies in my stomach. What am I forgetting? What's going to happen? What could occur on this trip? What have I not planned for? I've got three little kids with me. Like, it doesn't keep me from going anywhere, but I still run through it. Still in the OR, still in the ICU. Every time I'm about to stick a patient, it's like, how could this central line go wrong?
You know, as somebody with three kids myself who experiences similar anxieties, that really hits home for me. I wonder if you could talk about that feeling a little bit more.
Wow. This is not a direction I anticipated this interview going right out of the gate. So I guess that's fun. Always like to be challenged and have new experiences. So thank you for that. And putting me on my heels. So that's always good too. I think that much of what we do, much of what I've done in the military, much of what we do as physicians requires a tremendous sense of skepticism. And we're always planning for the worst and trying to come up with a plan to avoid it. I think sometimes when working with residents, they aren't scared enough. As they start to go through training, they've done it right a few times, things are going well, and they lose sense of that fear that junior residents have, and they forget how quickly this can turn sideways. And so they don't always have a good backup plan. And then one of my jobs and your job as the senior physician is to make sure that we always have our own backup plan, but also figure out how to educate them to be appropriately scared. So be confident, move forward, but have two or three backup plans. In the military, we call it a PACE plan: primary, alternate, contingency, and emergency plan. So
what was your backup plan for this podcast?
Delay. Put it off till tomorrow. You got me. So this is good. This is I wouldn't want it to be all scripted. So I don't want to live life in a scripted way. So hopefully this will be fun for people to listen to. And you and I don't know where this interview is going. So hopefully it'll be interesting to them too.
I'll get you back a little bit on track here. So I'm going to ask you a question that you have already thought about, which is, if you had the opportunity to have dinner with anyone, it could be somebody alive or dead, from past or from fiction, who would you have dinner with and why?
So I listened to an earlier podcast, and Dr. Lehman stole my favorite, which is Ben Franklin. I think he's a super interesting dude. Dr. Lehman glanced over the fact that the guy had a very interesting social history. Anybody who's interested, look at the time that Ben Franklin spent in France. Lots of fun was had by him and those around him. another person that I would love to meet would be Teddy Roosevelt. I think he's had a very interesting career. I mean, the guy got shot and finished his speech, right? Like, you know, rode up the hill in San Juan, was a fairly successful president, but also made some big mistakes, right? Like, left on maybe not ideal terms, tried to come back, didn't know how to let go. Like, there's so many interesting parts of his career that I would just love to chat with him about. If he was willing to actually have like a vulnerable conversation. So it's funny, I think about some of these people I'd love to talk to. And honestly, one of the things that comes up in my head is I'd love to have a vulnerable conversation with people about what was really in their head. Like, what was President Obama really thinking when he got the top secret report on the winnability of the war in Afghanistan in the mid-teens, right? I'd love to know what he thought, not what was published and not the answer he would give at a cocktail party.
Yeah, not the sanitized version.
Right. Like, how did you sleep with that? How did you make the decision to move forward? I went to Afghanistan the first time in 2010, and I went again in 2019 to fight the same war that we've been fighting for nearly 20 years by the time I went the second time. And so I'm curious about why I was there and what I accomplished and what, other than the small picture things that I did, I knew I was there to help people, which is one of the privileges of being a military physician. Wherever you go, your job is to heal. But as an American, I'm curious why I was there.
That's really interesting. Let's go back to the beginning of what motivated you to do everything, your whole career pathway. What inspired you to become a military physician? What are some of the choices you made along the way?
So I kind of always thought I wanted to be a doctor, always working in that direction from kind of middle school. I thought it was very interesting, human body, the brain.
Congratulations.
Right. Didn't know I was going to land in anesthesia. No idea about that. But had sort of a crisis of conscience in college. A lot of the pre-meds that I was sort of classmates with or met through sort of some of the test prep and things like that were very focused on getting into med school. That was the only thing they cared about, to the exclusion of the entire rest of their lives and the world. And I wasn't sure that I had that degree of commitment. And I was almost in some ways uncomfortable with the competitiveness. It seemed kind of cutthroat at times. And I ended up taking a year off, worked as a firefighter, waited tables, like enjoyed my life. And I realized, okay, you need a real job. Like, let's go back to med school. Let's do this. And I went to the Uniformed Services University, applied there. And they answered a lot of the questions that I had. We were teammates at USU. There was no competition amongst us. If you felt like you had a good understanding of a current topic or a course, you wrote course notes and they got disseminated to the whole class. Everybody was on board with everybody else. We got notes from last year's class. People pass things around among each other. If somebody was struggling, like somebody who was performing well in the class sort of automatically paired up with them to help them. You knew that once you graduated, you might be an ER doc, but that OB-GYN was going to be delivering your wife's baby at, you know, Eglin Air Force Base in 5 years, right? Like, you wanted everyone to pass and learn and do well because we were in this together.
That makes sense. I've always been sort of an advocate, maybe subconsciously, of the team mentality myself. I remember when I was doing medical school interviews, I went to a medical school, which shall remain unnamed, And they mentioned, oh yeah, you have to watch out because sometimes people will hide the books in the library after they find out that a particular book is, you know, something that the professor is going to recommend. That book will get hidden, so you have to go to the library quickly and get it. And that was an immediate and permanent turnoff for me for the culture of that institution, and I no longer was interested in going there.
Absolutely, absolutely. And I was fortunate. USU answered a lot of those questions, and I did okay, and I had a good time, and it helped me get to where I needed to be in medicine.
So how does that intersect with joining a branch of the military? Can you tell me how that all works?
So you apply to USU as a medical school first. You have to meet certain, you know, fit to serve standards, which are just, it's a basic physical exam. You can't have any major medical problems because you have to be worldwide deployable when it's over.
And USU stands for?
Sorry, Uniformed Services University.
Excellent. Okay.
Very creative name that the government has given to its active duty medical school. So we're about a third Army, a third Navy, and a third Air Force. About half of us were prior service and half had no prior service. You had to get into the medical school on its own merits, and then you could pick which service you wanted to be in. Air Force filled up first, and then Army and Navy. I was fortunate. I have a family history of a lot of people that were in the Air Force, and so I kind of gravitated to that pretty naturally.
That's not normally the way that we use the words family history, but I'll take it in this context. I also have a family history of the Air Force with my dad.
Awesome. Awesome. None of my immediate family were in the military. It was all kind of grandparents, aunts, uncles, cousins. What did your dad do for the Air Force?
He was a lawyer in the Air Force, so he did sort of the JAG stuff, that kind of thing.
Awesome. The docs and the lawyers tend to interact a little bit more often than some of the other folks. Not in a negative way, just as advisors to the commander. So you have line officers that are in charge of sort of directing planes and bombs and soldiers. And then you have sort of the people that advise them on the side. Doctors and lawyers are kind of advisors.
That makes a lot of sense. Okay, so what was next in your career pathway?
So I did a surgical internship at Wright-Patt, and then I went and did a 5-year general medical officer tour as a flight doc for Air Force Special Operations Command. So I was assigned to a flying squadron, the U model, the AC-130. So it is the gunship. So any of you guys that play video games where there's a gunship overhead and you can call in airstrikes, I was the flight doc for that airplane. So I was responsible for the medical care of everybody in that squadron. So about 400 folks, I was their primary care doctor, and I did all of their aeromedical physical exams. And then I deployed with them or with other special operations units to provide basic medical care and trauma medical care. Obviously, I was at a base. If things got complicated, we could always refer them to other sort of medical. But my job was to be embedded in the squadron and to be comfortable with having them come to me. Flyers are on a very strict physical profile, so there's a lot of things they're not allowed to do. There's heavy restrictions on any medications, and medical problems can severely impact their career. And so they're notorious for hiding all kinds of things. So one of my jobs is to get in close and make sure that I'm someone they can trust. So they know that if it's real and if I can see that it's real, that we do need to pause and talk about it, and that they don't need to be scared to talk about other things. They can come to you and say, I'm having this problem. Is this a big deal? And you can say, no, you're fine. Don't worry about it. I'll work the paperwork. You can keep flying. Or, you know, this does matter. Like it's okay. We need to have a pause and we need to address this. That way it's safe for you and it's safe for everybody else and it's safe for your family.
So it's kind of like a Gattaca scenario almost.
A little bit. Yep. A little bit.
So held to very high standards. Obviously you need to be when you're flying a military aircraft, but you're the guy who is supposed to engender their trust such that they can tell you if they're having that problem. That seems like a big deal.
Or you can see it. So I flew combat missions downrange with these guys. I flew with them at home. It was a wonderful opportunity to just sort of make friends and hang out. And then, you know, if somebody's partner or wife cut their hand cooking dinner on a Saturday. I got a phone call. I went over and threw a few stitches in somebody. They didn't have to go to the ED. You know, obviously, if it was something serious, we would go to the ER. But it was concierge medicine, if you will, for pilots and crews and their families. And then it got a little bit less concierge in Afghanistan and Africa, where I lived in a tent. But, you know, conceptually, it was the same.
Before we get to living in a tent in Afghanistan, I wanted to ask you, how can you tell if a pilot is a little bit off of their game? Obviously, if they crash the plane that you're on, that's probably an indication that they shouldn't fly anymore. But what are some more of the subtle signs that you might be picking up on?
So I think that there's a lot. So you can look. I was with a heavily deployed squadron that had a lot of combat stress at the time that I was there. And so people would at times make bad decisions in their personal lives, risk-taking behaviors, things like that. I was surprised how many people just came to me with normal stuff like, hey, I'm thinking about trying to have a kid with my wife. What does that look like? Or like, you know, we tried to have a kid and pregnancy was hard. And so this is a stressor. And like, you know, and I'm like, hey, you know, there are people that can help with this. And most of the time, they were pretty well balanced. They're very high performing, very healthy folks from a screening perspective already. And I think just being there to connect them with more resources to say, hey, like, this is heavy. Let's get you an appointment for, you know, here's how you could get some mental health counseling if you wanted it.
Sure. That makes sense. I imagine, and I've seen both of the Top Gun movies, the old one and the new one. I assume that those are 100% accurate.
I will tell you that it's crazy flying in those jets. It's intense.
Tell me more about that.
I have had one opportunity to fly in a high performance aircraft. It was a T-38 trainer jet. It is the last jet you fly in before you fly in an F-15 or an F-16. And some countries actually use them as their frontline fighter jets. It was so much fun. We were in the air for an hour and it was exhausting. An hour is almost a full day's work in those aircraft. So you're pulling G's. And, you know, it's summer in Texas, you're sweating to death, you lose, you know, 3 liters of water over a 1 hour flight, like you're dehydrated. I got to fly with two other doc buddies. We each had an instructor in front of us and an instructor behind us and we were in the seats. And, I just chased a buddy around the sky in a fighter jet for an hour. It was one of the most remarkable experiences of my life.
How did you make that happen?
So I was at flight surgeon training school and they said, okay, you need some experience flying jets if you're going to work with pilots and know how to talk to them.
That sounds incredible.
It was amazing. And then the next week they put me in an aerobatics biplane with a stunt pilot and we flew like loop-de-loos and Cuban eights and all these kind of weird, they put a parachute on me. The pilot said, listen, dude, there's one door and I'm a big guy. You've got about 3 seconds to get out of the plane when I say bail out. Otherwise, I am going to knock this seat flat and I'm going out the door. So just to be clear up front, I was like, what is going on in my life right now?
So I can imagine a loop-de-loop. That makes sense to me. Do you say a cube?
A Cuban eight. It's like a figure eight in the sky. It's like gravity doesn't matter. The Air Force's big trick is we overcame gravity, and I have been the beneficiary of that on a few different occasions. So,
wow, that does sound truly incredible.
Yeah, I mean, I've done so many things in my career and kind of not related to medicine, just being in the Air Force, that I didn't know to fantasize about as a child, right? Like I didn't know that I could fly an aerobatics plane. I didn't know that I could jump out of helicopters. There's all these things. And I was like, I didn't fantasize about that. It was just amazing.
Tell me about jumping out of a helicopter.
That was one of the scarier things I've ever done. So You guys can't see this in the podcast, but I'm only about 5'7". I am not your classic special forces soldier, right? I'm the doc. My job is to be the doc. They gave me a gun. I kept it locked up. Like, I'm the doc. I got to go through some of the training with some of these guys. And one night we were fast roping out of the back of a helicopter, and the rope sits off the tailgate of the helicopter. We were only about 20 feet, hovering 20 feet in the air. And my arms aren't super long, and I couldn't reach the rope with my full hand. I could feel it in the dark against the tips of my fingers, and I was not going to wimp out. And so I just leaned forward and jumped and hoped that my hands would get wrapped around the rope. And I'm sure it was nothing, but God, did it scare me. And I was like, I'd rather break my ankle than look like a wimp. So we're going for it.
That sounds like the kind of person that you'd have to be in order to jump out of a helicopter.
So it gets back to, I guess, where we started, right? Like, I was always scared of all these things, but also just kind of got to press forward, right? Like, there's always butterflies and you still got to go.
So what was it like when you were in a tent in Afghanistan?
So, it's funny. I spent more time in tents in Africa.
Okay.
I had like a plywood hut in Afghanistan the first time I went, that was highly flammable, and had a mouse problem. But other than that, like, there was good camaraderie. The bathrooms were kind of far away, so you had to walk outside in the snow in Afghanistan, but you know, you get over that part. It was my first trip, I went with Special Operations. My second trip, I went with CCAT, so the Critical Care Air Evacuation Teams. Two slightly different experiences, but both interesting, and just, again, got to see amazing things and do interesting stuff.
Tell me about some of this interesting stuff.
So, let's talk about CCAT. So that's the Critical Care Air Transport Team, my role here.
I can see some of the wheels turning in your head, as he's trying in front of me. Jesse is trying very hard to make everything still classified, to stay classified.
I did a lot of things for Air Force Special Operations Command that are sensitive topics, and, probably easier to talk about some of the medical things that I did in Afghanistan.
Sure. Let's stay away from divulging classified information on the podcast. It's probably, yes, a bad look.
Yes. So our team was stationed in Afghanistan in 2019, a three-person team, a doc, a nurse, and a respiratory therapist. And we were one of the tactical teams. So we had a little bit of extra tactical training, so that we could take patients, in and out of less secure locations. We also provided transport from Afghanistan back to Germany, which was our first staging hospital outside of, the theater of operations. So I had a few interesting little missions around Afghanistan, often quick, fun stuff. Go sit here and pick this guy up. Took care of a gentleman that was on a team that was hunting for a sniper. They had killed one of our special operations soldiers two nights prior. And so they went back to look for the guy in the same spot. And they found him. And he found them first again and shot another one of our soldiers. This was a GSW, through the patient, right to left through the abdomen. So interestingly, the round went through his rifle, through his abdomen, and lodged in his wrist.
Wow.
So we found out that he was shot before he was even taken out of the field. I was able to get to the tent hospital that was going to do his damage control surgery about the same time that he did. He went into the operating room. They stabilized him there. And then we picked him up, packaged him up, and flew him back to Bagram for additional surgery, and then eventually flight back to the United, or back to Germany, and then back to the United States.
That sounds like the most condensed version of what you did that I can possibly imagine. I wonder, if you could set the scene for us about what it looks like when you're loading a wounded soldier onto an aircraft and what your specific job is when you're doing all of these really interesting things and sort of how that intersects with what we do in anesthesia.
Right. That's fair. So, yeah, I brushed through a few details there. So we were staged outside of the main hospital in Bagram, and we've got aircraft staged there for us and a full set of equipment. And when we get notified that there is an injury or a patient that needs to be transported quickly, it takes us about 30 minutes to grab all of our equipment, throw it in a truck, drive it to the aircraft, load the aircraft, and then get up in the air. From there, it really depends on how far away you are. I think it takes a lot of attention to detail to make sure that you're being organized when you're doing something so quickly and so emergently. You could be dead asleep and you have 30 minutes to be awake, dressed, packaged, and out the door. Checklists became a huge thing. So I always have a checklist hanging in the garage where we kept all of our equipment. We would load it onto the trucks, or sometimes other folks would help us load it onto the trucks. But the last thing we always did before we left is my respiratory therapist would stand at the truck and he would eyeball equipment bag by bag. And I would read the checklist. And until I got an affirmative on each item, we didn't go. Because once you're in the air, you can't, if I forgot my defibrillator, well, there's no defibrillator. There's no, you're your own thing. We were able to load up. We didn't know what we were getting. We knew that the guys were still taking fire when we were first notified. And then when we finally landed, it was dark. Special operations works at night. Gives us an advantage with our NVGs. Night vision goggles. The enemy mostly doesn't have those. And we have them for like almost every one of our soldiers that needs them. That gives us a huge advantage. So we fly at night, land at night. We waited on the runway and we were able to watch the medevac helicopter. So the local dust off helicopters are Army point of injury evacuation. So they can go into kind of like in Vietnam, you know, the helicopter flies in and picks somebody up while they're still potentially not a secure area. My job with CCAT is more traditionally a somewhat secure scene. And the reason for that is that I'm on a fixed wing aircraft, so it's less maneuverable and it's a bigger target than, say, a traditional helicopter. So the helicopter would bring them back to the tent surgeon. They're set up to do one or two operations. They did their operation, stabilized the guy, took him about an hour and a half, I think. I was able to then, transfer him to our equipment. So we bring our own ventilators, we bring our own monitors, suction, all of that. I've got all my own drugs. I've got, gear in a backpack essentially for any kind of trauma that could come up to stabilize the patient, chest tubes, Krike kits. This guy was intubated, so we put him on our ventilator. We loaded him in the back of a pickup truck and drove him about, 15, 20 minutes back to the airfield with his buddies. So his buddies helped me transport him back to the aircraft, which I think was important for them. They were able to see him. They had just lost a fellow soldier night before. And then this guy got shot. And so they were able to see him go into the operating room, see him come out stable, and then get transported back to Bagram. In flight, pretty uneventful. The surgeon did a good job. The patient, we kept them sedated. It was only about, a 30 or 45 minute flight. Land in Bagram and unload the guy, put him on an ambulance, take him into the main hospital where they have tremendous medical capability. They had a trauma surgeon as well as a dozen other surgeons. So vascular, ENT, OMFS, orthopedic surgery, general surgery, nurses, all of that stuff. So it's not, the hospital is very robust that we had at that time.
So when you're on this critical care transport and there's this guy in front of you that you're keeping alive, what's going through your head? What's your mental model for all this?
Don't screw it up. Wow. So there is so much that can go on. So I think the first thing you have to do is think about the injury pattern and what are the risks. So this guy was an abdominal wound. You know, there's a certain set of things you worry about in a patient that's been shot in the abdomen versus a patient that fell and broke a leg, or a person that was in a blast injury and has a TBI or had a heart attack. I flew a patient from Bagram back to Germany emergently that had a heart attack. There's no cath lab in Bagram. So we took him to Germany and went to the cath lab and emergent CABG. Right. So like it's a different, obviously, subset of injuries, complications. So you run through what could go wrong in this patient, and then you come up with your top three things that could go wrong and are life-threatening, right? So there's a few things that can go wrong that just doesn't matter that much. You know, like if you, you know, I don't know, some over-sedation, we can give a little bit more pressor, right? I'm not trying to extubate this guy in flight. If he's a little deep, so be it. I'm going to err on the side of heavy sedation and pain control.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense.
Versus what happens if we hook the ET tube or the ventilator circuit on, you know, a random bag as we're walking down the aisle in this airplane and I extubate the patient. Okay, what's my plan? Where is my gear? What do I need to do to reintubate this guy? Is he a difficult airway? Does he have trauma in his airway, or is this just a normal? No, this was an isolated GSW to the abdomen. We can bag him for half an hour until we get to Bagram. We can put in an LMA. I keep a Craig in my pocket. I have, you know, all the ET tubes. I have a video. I have a DL. Like, I have options. So it's kind of all those things kind of go through your head. And then looking out for your team is part of it too. So I was the most experienced person on the team, the senior physician. I was the only physician, senior medical provider, but also this was my fourth deployment, and my colleagues were newer that were on my team. And so little things like making sure that everybody's clipped into the floor and secure for takeoff. Just double checking stuff like that, helping ensure that we're all on the same page and communicating well with the air crew and with each other.
So what does it look like when you reach your destination?
So again, really depends on where you're going. So I flew into all kinds of crazy places, never knew what I was getting. Going to pick patients up. They always ask me, so, you know, what's the plan? And we always had a plan. And the only thing that never happened was the plan. Literally guaranteed something else would happen. They tell me that you're going to just land at the airfield and we're going to bring the patient out to you. They should be there. They're going to radio us on final approach and we'll drive them right out. They open the tailgate on the C-130 and somebody is sitting there in a Ford Taurus waiting to take me to the hospital. And I'm like, bro, where do I put the litter in a Ford Taurus? Right? I got 600 pounds of gear, three dudes in armor, like a guy, a gal, and me. Sorry, not three dudes. And is this a joke? Go get a truck. But go get a truck, man. I'll wait.
Yeah, I don't know that the Taurus is necessarily equipped to handle all of your gear.
No. Or the patient. How are we going to get back from the hospital in a Ford Taurus? Like, it was so... Anyway, the plan was always something other than the plan.
That makes a lot of sense.
And then when you get back to Bagram, so you come into a big trauma bay and you hand off to very well-equipped teams of ER physicians, nurses. Traumas are overseeing it all. There's more hands. I was always amazed at how many hands there were at Bagram. When we flew into Ramstein, that was a little different too. So in Germany, Ramstein Airfield, where we fly in and out of, is geographically separated from Landstuhl Army Base, which has the hospital. So it's about a 20 or 30 minute ride. So you land, unload, get in an ambulance, and you have to sort of drive through Germany. the patient I took care of that had the MI, we drove him downtown, actually. So we rolled into a civilian hospital in, you know, full military fatigues, sweaty and smelly after, you know, 18 hours starting the day in Afghanistan, and rolled right up into the hospital. My nurse was amazing. She had spent some of her grade school in Germany. Her father was military 40 years prior, and she spoke German. who would have thought that that was going to be such a useful skill? And so we were able to very seamlessly hand the patient over to the German team, and they evaluated him and took him to the operating room.
Wow. This all sounds like incredible experience.
It is. It is. It's funny you asked, what does it look like? And the answer is, it looks like whatever you plan and come up with and have three backup plans for. So if you don't come up with a plan and a backup plan, it does not work well. You really do have to continue to communicate to try to come up with a way to make it happen for the patient. That's really what matters, is making it happen for the patient.
So you've had all of this military experience. How does that translate to what you do here at the University of Cincinnati?
So obviously one of my roles is teaching that course so that other people can go do that job. So obviously that's a direct translation. That one's pretty easy. I'm surprised how often it helps in sort of civilian medicine too. We transport a patient every time we leave the operating room, right? And sometimes they're critically ill. And when you're packaging up your patient to bring them to the ICU, it's really easy to overlook that. And I think that that can result in complications. I know I've seen some at various hospitals of people failing to sort of adequately prepare and continue to monitor that patient, even if it's only for 10 minutes. That's all it takes to have a bad outcome. And I take that opportunity. One of the things that I always do with the residents is I ask them what could go wrong in the next 10 minutes and what's your plan, right? And that's obviously that got drilled into my head because I had to fly for 10 hours. But you still need to have a plan. You still need to think about those things. It's a shorter list of things that can go wrong in 10 minutes, right? But I still think it's there. And so the fact that it's been so drilled into my head, I just use that opportunity. I expect residents to learn something different from everybody they work with every day. And so maybe that's one of the things they can learn from me if we have a chance to work together.
So how old are your kids?
7, 11, and 13.
Whenever you're getting ready to go on a family vacation, do you go through a list of all the things that could go wrong with them and what you expect them to do in those situations?
I go through the list of things that could go wrong with the weather. Do you have a coat?
Excellent.
Other than that, no, I try not to put too much of that on them. I try to take that responsibility.
I've noticed, you know, my wife is actually very good at this sort of thing, and she is responsible for the pre-mission checklist or
yeah,
whatever it is. But in my head, I'm also with you. I'm constantly imagining what things could go wrong. You know, what would happen if the car stopped here? What would we do? You know, and I think that that's just sort of one of the ways that our brains operate as anesthesiologists, right? Like that's the worst case scenario is sort of always on our mind,
right,
or at least in the back of our mind, so that,
right,
we can plan for it and do something about it if it ever were to happen.
Yeah, I do. And I think I definitely, as things come up, I do find myself getting into pedantic doctor, dad, attending instructor, whatever role with the kids too. So, and then they roll their eyes, but I like to think maybe the words are going into their ears, even if they're, you know, sort of, you know, blowing me off with their eyes, that maybe in the future those words will be there.
You know, I didn't really think that as a dad, I was super into safety any more than any other parent. But the first time that I realized what I was doing to my children was when my son came home after having ridden a school bus for the first time. And I said, "Hey, how was school? Did you like riding the school bus?" He said, "No, Dad, not really." Why? It's like, "Dad, the school bus, it doesn't have seat belts."
That's funny. Yeah. Yeah.
It's like, wow, I have really drilled that into you about the critical importance of it, but I didn't realize that.
I wasn't trying to damage you.
Yeah, I wasn't.
I wasn't trying to scar you.
It's going to be okay, buddy. The school bus, you know, cars usually will stop for this.
No, wait, same thing in my house. Same thing. Like, if you start driving before the seatbelt's on, like some of the kids get anxious.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. Like my son has also commented like, hey dad, you need to put your seatbelt on. Buddy, we're still in the driveway.
But yes,
your concern has been noted and you're right.
Back in the boat down a ramp. Okay.
Like, yeah.
It's okay.
It'll be okay. Okay. So let's talk a little bit more in granular detail about what you do in your teaching roles. You just took me on this excellent tour of the simulation center that's here. Tell me all about it.
Wow. So we have, I think, the preeminent, if I can say that, simulation facility in the country, at least as far as the product that we deliver with the students. It's not all of our mannequins aren't the newest. All of our drugs aren't always the freshest, but they're mannequin drugs. So, and we do a lot of repairs on a day-to-day basis. But I think that the medical scenarios that we present are so high fidelity and the way we run our simulations, it's absolutely incredible. The course is a 2-week course. So the first week is primarily academics, with some introduction to simulation, and a big logistics exercise that involves real flight on a C-130. And then the second week is the grading week where they go into, one 30 to 60 minute high fidelity simulation with 2 to 3 patients, as a team every day. So you get graded each day. We rotate the teams. So you do 5 simulations with a variety of partners. You're graded by a strict rubric. And then you get feedback and you watch your own videos so that you can try to continue to learn each day and improve. I think that the things that set apart our simulations are very robust patient scenarios. So our patients have, they're all, almost all of them, except for the distractor patients, are critically ill. And so they have real ABGs. Many of them are real patients that have been flown by various cadre around the world. So they have a full story. And then we make the patient look like the story. We don't give the students information. The students evaluate the patient and learn information. So the instructor doesn't tell you what the blood pressure is. You can zero the A-line and plug it into your monitor, and then you will get an A-line tracing. Or you can run a cuff pressure, and then you will get a blood pressure. If you run one cuff pressure and you don't set it to automatic, when the pressure falls in the next 3 to 5 minutes, you won't notice. And so it is very real. If you want to sedate your patient, you don't, tell us what you're going to give. You draw a medication, you pull a medication from your bag, your backpack, whatever your gear set. We have a medication box. It's our real world medication box. It's got fake drugs at this point, but it's all of the drugs that you would normally carry in the real world. You draw it out in a syringe and you push it in the appropriate dose and you flush it. And until you flush that medication and I watch you flush it from one of a dozen cameras in the room, they don't get a response. And when you flush that sedation medication, I don't say, okay, the patient feels more relaxed. I drop the heart rate. I lower the blood pressure a touch. I close the patient's eyes, and I make them stop overbreathing the vent. And that's how you know that it worked. You may cause hypotension if you choose to give propofol as your sedative of choice in a trauma patient. Obviously, that's high risk. You want to give 10 cc's of propofol, or sorry, you want to give 10 milligrams of propofol to a patient, I'm not going to give you any response because I don't think 10 milligrams does anything. On the other hand, if you give 70 milligrams of propofol to a patient who is volume down after a damage control surgery, I'm going to tank their pressure. Right? I would prefer that you picked something a little more hemodynamically stable, like a benzo or ketamine or even fentanyl, right? Any one of those is going to have a lesser impact on their hemodynamics. And so I'm grading that. So I'm not only am I grading your decision making, I am watching to see if you can execute the task correctly. So it's surprising how challenging that can be at times with things that you're not used to doing. So as an example, setting up a levofed drip. If you program the pump wrong and you deliver 100 times the dose of medication, your blood pressure is going to be 300 over 200. right? And so then you're going to have to go back and say, why is my blood pressure 300 over 200? And so it's all real. It's not, we don't feed information to the patient, to the teams. They have to provide care to the patient, and then they will see what happens and continue to adjust and zero in.
So I assume afterwards you're doing a big debrief with them, right?
So yes, we debrief all of our simulations. We debrief as a group. Unfortunately, it's only about 10 minutes. And then we debrief as individuals, doc to doc, nurse to nurse, RT to RT, respiratory therapist to respiratory therapist. And you get more feedback on how to function in the team and how to improve your skills as an individual. But then you do get the chance to watch the simulation with your team. And we consider that to be part of the debrief. If I say something to you after the simulation, and then you get a chance to see yourself doing it, it really kind of highlights what it was that you were doing. So a common area that we focus on is communication. So people will say something and their partner doesn't hear it. And so we focus on closed loop communication. So it's amazing how often you can see this as the instructor and they don't see it as students. The doc doesn't know that the nurse told them something. And the nurse is like, I said it. And so it's like, oh no, you said it while the doctor was trying to intubate the patient and there was no closed loop feedback. So you have to make sure that you're telling somebody at a time when they are able to listen, and then you want closed loop feedback. And if you don't get the answer you want, you need to circle back, and like you have to maintain situational awareness and all these things. And on one hand, they can sort of grasp it when they go back and they watch the video and they're like, I see exactly what you're talking about, right? Like, that really hammers that home. And then we have additional cadre that are available for further clarification and debrief as they sort of reflect on their simulation throughout the course of the rest of the day or the next day.
So I'm sure you've seen a lot of situations where people have done a variety of different performances during their simulation. You've seen people that have done very, very well, and I'm sure you've seen people who have done very, very poorly. As an instructor for some time now, what's your approach to talking to the people who have done poorly and then maybe to the people who've done well?
So let me start with the easy one, is the people that do well. We kind of warn the students, you're going to get feedback no matter how well you do. Everybody gets feedback on every simulation, no matter what. Nobody's perfect. And so I try to highlight, hey, you know, what were the goals? What did you achieve? That's good. You guys did a good job. Here's little things that you can think about, or things that could have come up that didn't, or things that you did that are, you know, in a different situation might be more challenging as far as feedback for the ones that are kind of performing at or above goal. For people that are struggling, I think that everybody struggles for different reasons, and some things we can coach and correct, and some things we can't. I think one of the challenges is people that don't have the opportunity to practice medicine on a daily basis with sick patients. And it's really hard to come here and then manage a simulated really sick patient if you don't get a chance to do that on a regular basis. And so we need people that are clinically current in their practice. And that's one of the things we ask of people when they show up. We need you to bring your clinical currency. If you think that you're sort of out of practice on something, we'd like you to seek that out before you get here. One of the big areas that we focus on is communication and team dynamics. We're a three-person team. Most ICUs are not cared for by, or most ICU patients in a fixed facility are not cared for by one doctor, one nurse, and one respiratory therapist, right? Like, so we all take on slightly different roles. I do a lot of nursing tasks. My nurse can do a lot of doctor things. They can titrate meds. They can titrate pressors and sedation. They don't need permission to give a bolus of an opioid to a critically ill patient if they're under-sedated. They're expected to sort of function semi-independently, more like you would almost practice as a nurse practitioner in some cases. My RTs are doing a lot of non-respiratory tasks. In addition to being responsible for suction, commonly responsible for lots of equipment, assisting with a whole host of tasks. They're sort of like scrub tech light, in some ways, right? Or OR nurse light, where they will gather supplies for things. They'll find the drugs. They'll mix or they'll hang a bag of fluids, crystalloids, and basic things like that. And so it's trying to teach people how to work in that environment. Like, okay, this is what's fair to ask, and this is a way for you as a doc to communicate better with your nurse or as a team. And so that's a common area that we kind of focus on. So, you know, watch the video and look and see, you know, when you asked your nurse to do these five things, look at the nurse and look at their face. I could see their face in the simulation. They got a little bit confused and didn't know where to start because nobody can do five tasks at once. You know, or you ask them to do three things while they were trying to calculate how to mix a bag of Levofed. The Levofed didn't come from the pharmacy. Your nurse literally had to find a vial in the med box, find a bag of crystalloid, draw it up and mix it on their own. So they're task saturated. Don't ask your nurse for a flush when they're doing math. It's not fair, right? It's just not fair. And so it's little things like that that we can sort of coach and help with. And some of it's just practice. Some of it's just giving people the confidence to just keep going and keep trying, and you'll get there.
That makes a lot of sense. And I appreciate you sharing your experience as an instructor over there too. Sort of summing up, I wonder how you would describe your military experience in terms of, is this what you thought you were going to do with your life? Is this something that you're glad that you've done with your life? Can you reflect on that for me?
Wow. You got me at an interesting point in my career. I was just selected for promotion to full colonel.
Congratulations.
Thank you. It comes with a lot. There's a lot associated with that. And it pushes a career in a different direction. And so I've had a lot of opportunities to sort of reflect on my career lately. And I had no idea about so many of these things. I think by the time I was nearing the end of college, I wasn't even sure I was going to med school anymore. And found the right thing with USU, and that went well. And I thought I wanted to be an orthopedic surgeon, and I did a year of surgery and, sort of figured out, no, anesthesia is where I want to be. But when you switch directions, it takes time. And so I ended up having this amazing tour with, Air Force Special Operations, like things there that I did, like I had no idea how much fun, how interesting, how wild some of these things could be. You know, defensive driving courses, racing cars through the woods at night on NVGs blacked out. Did you know that that's what we do in the forests of northern Florida? No, me neither.
I did not.
Until I got there, I had no idea. It was wild. It's a ton of fun. I had no idea. And then the opportunity I got to go to the University of Pennsylvania for my residency and my fellowship, like, I am convinced that that is a function of the experiences that the Air Force gave me. It was not based on my academic record, my scores, my board scores and this and that were never great. But I learned so much practicing as a GMO flight doc, and learning how to work with teams, learning how to work with nurses, learning how to talk to patients. And I guess that came through in the interview, and I got to go one of the top programs in the country. Like, I was way out of my league, and it was amazing. And they took good care of me and taught me a million things. And I'm super fortunate for that. And then this job here is a dream job in the Air Force. It's an absolute dream job. You get to work at a high volume trauma center and still get to do like some really cool military stuff, from the perspective of CCAT. That's really a gem, in the Air Force's crown. If you think about it, like the ability to fly a sick patient anywhere in the world, no matter what, that's what we do.
Lastly, I wonder if you could share with us, going back to the title of the podcast, some of your style points that you've picked up along the way.
I think that learning about nursing and how to work with nurses is probably the single biggest style point that I absolutely did not have and made heinous mistakes at the beginning of my career. And it is absolutely one of my greatest strengths and helps me so much now. Throughout my career, I've learned by making numerous mistakes. I don't think most of them came at the expense of patients. I think it came at the expense of peace and collaboration and happiness and kindness. Many of those things suffered, and that's where I made mistakes. I wish I hadn't learned all those things the hard way. But having learned them and having learned sort of what nurses do and how to work professionally with nurses has made me so much better at my job. Being at CCAT, where we're on a 3-person team, yeah, I'm a doc. Yes, they're a nurse. Yes, this one's a respiratory therapist, but we're all doctors, we're all nurses, and we're all respiratory therapists on the plane. And learning so much about what they do and how to work better with them has made me a much better physician, a much better advocate for my patients, much better at coordinating care in the ICU. And I think that's the style point, is learning how to work with the people, the support staff, et cetera, and really understand what they do. And as a doc, learning how to work with nurses, is huge. It's huge.
Jesse, thank you so much for your service, and thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you. This was awesome. This was a lot of fun. Thank you.
That wraps it up for this month's episode of Style Points. This year, I only asked Santa for one thing. It was for listeners of this podcast to take just a second and give me a 5-star review. Why, you ask? Well, it's what helps other people find the podcast. The more ratings I get, the more likely it is to show up in someone else's suggestions. If you're enjoying it, chances are that somebody else might enjoy it too. If you've got an idea for the podcast, feel free to email me at stylepointspodcast@gmail.com. I'd love to hear it. As always, thanks for listening. Take a deep breath. Open your eyes. We're all done.